welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm the editor and webmaster of redicecreations.com. And this is our internet talk radio show recorded from the west coast of Sweden. You can join us every Thursday and Sunday for our regular program, and don't miss out on our subscriber section if you want to have full access to our growing archive of radio shows. Today we have our monthly regular guest Alan Watt from CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com back with us on the program. We're a bit off in our schedule. Alan is usually with us the last Sunday of each month. But because of some work on film projects from our end, we're about a week off here, but that's okay. Any time is a good time to talk with Alan. And today I would like to begin to talk about the Bilderberg Group, or the conference. This annually held meeting is usually sometime during the month of June, and as far as we know it, it's ongoing right now, as of this recording is anyway, and probably going to be going on through the entire weekend here. So this is a good opportunity to spend some time talking about this group and a lot more stuff with Alan. So let's say welcome back to the program, Mr. Watt. Thank you so much for joining us again. Hope things are good and that you are well.
Yes, I'm well, yep.
Excellent. Nice to have you here again. So, you know, as I said, we have the Bilderberg meeting ongoing, as far as we know right now. It's usually in the month of June. The location of the meeting this year is in Istanbul, Turkey. And the Bilderberg Group, of course, is a think tank. I've also heard it been referred to as a kind of a steering committee, you know, that meet once a year on various locations around the globe, usually in the Western Hemisphere, I think. And where allegedly and everything from international matters, politics, business, economics, and a whole lot of other stuff are discussed at this meeting. It's a known secret meeting, as it were, with politicians, media moguls, CEOs, members of European royalty, and a whole lot of other people, as would consider to be referred to as elites, I guess, or rulers or whatnot. And Alan, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the history of the Bilderbergers and their track record, so to speak. I know that it was started in 54 and that the name relates to the hotel that they were first meeting at in Netherlands. We have hints in there, here and there, about what are being discussed at this meeting. Not sure if there's any, you know, full reports, as it were, from the inside. I know that they were in Ottawa, Canada last year, and we've been talking about many different groups and clubs and societies, secret and not, and on this show, of course, Alan. But so let me ask you, would you consider this particular group to be of great importance if you were to kind of compare them from a conspiratorial viewpoint with other similar groups?
Well, before World War II came along, long before World War II came along, in fact, it was the time of World War I, the elite of Europe, especially Britain, discussed the coming, what they called democracies, which really hadn't existed in their present form at that time. And they knew they'd have to appease the people with a form of what appeared to be democratic government on the outside, where they could vote. Mm. Mind you, that's the only right they get, is to vote.
Yeah.
They don't get rights in making decisions on what's to be voted for, with the bills they all go through.
Yeah.
And they'd never let go of power. There is an establishment, as they call it, in Britain, which has never lost hold of its power, never intends to. It's a eugenic-run society, you might say,
mm-hmm.
with the most successful, as their own words, the most successful families intergenerationally who've caught wealth and power and held on to it, who've shown their worth in a Darwinian viewpoint, to be where they are. So prior to World War II coming along, they'd already set up the basic foundations to run a parallel government, which would actually push towards global government. It was way back in history to the 1500s, and actually before.
Hmm.
But the 1500s was when it came out into the open, where they wanted a British empire based on free trade, and they even gave the term most favored nation trading status, which they still use today in the UN treaties, you'll notice. So they set up a pyramid structure after World War II of think tanks, with certain think tanks at the top that would be the steering, they call them the navigators at the top. At the top you have one of them which plans the future and the society that will be induced in that future with the culture and everything else to go with it. That's from entertainment all the way down, and it's comprised of very large media moguls who participate with the planners, the navigators, and that's the Club of Rome. And that think tank then gives out their policies to lower think tanks, there are thousands of them ultimately, that then work them into being, they call it making it so, making it be. And one of the groups which then goes over their major strategies and discusses how it is working, if any alterations need to be made, are the Bilderberger Group. The Bilderberger Group always have members of royalty attending. They have the members of the banking institutions attending because they have to finance it. And H.G. Wells wrote about this particular structure before it was named, in fact, in some of his writings. He said, we shall need to bring in the bankers on board because they understand economics and will have to finance this global system. So the Bilderbergers, remember the high institution that runs this, Build the Future. And so they named the hotel long in advance for the meeting, and they called it the Builder. The, you build the mountain, the berg.
And
that's what it means. They also take future prime ministers and presidents before the public even hear their names often and ask them to attend. Then they, if they're accepted, they're invited and okayed, they get their, they'll get to be president or prime minister before the public even know their names.
That's interesting about the name there, because this was one question I did wanted to put to you, or idea rather, and this was, you know, the fact that the story goes, you know, that some don't know the name of him, a guy, you know, stumbled upon this meeting at the hotel called Bilderberg. And what I found interesting was that they consequently, you know, called themselves the Bilderberg meeting, because this is a group that has been named by someone from the outside then. But, you know,
in a sense, or else they leaked it out or put a false story through. So they're very particular about their names. So yeah, they love these names. It's a little jokes on the public.
Because you know, again, when we look at the, you know, the official, there is one circulated report. There's a picture of that, you know, on Wikipedia, even from the 1980 Bilderberg conference in Bad Aachen in Germany. There's one fax that was circulated from the Brook Street Hotel in Ottawa last year, and this fax. On the front cover, this was the member list fax, basically, that was sent to the hotel there. And on that fax, it also said, you know, the Bilderberg meeting. So that's a, that is, the, you know, very much the official name. But then again, if someone were there stumbling upon this meeting, one would think that they had named themselves something else else before the first meeting. But, well, anyway.
Yeah, they were on the go before they eventually came out more in the open.
Yeah, they must have been. So
in the 1950s.
So, I mean, this, you know, I don't know if this is worth mentioning, but in a sense, could that imply in some ways that this particular group, you know, is there to draw, not attention away from other groups maybe, but in a way, as I, you know, referred to you before we began the program here today, that this particular meeting has gotten, at least in the last few years, more media attention than a lot of other meetings, and it's a kind of popular, you know, conspiracy in quotes, so to speak. Well, I don't know, what's your take on that?
It's not really. What it is the gradual. See, they wrote about this again in the early 1900s, and they said that these unelected ruling groups, a parallel government, would eventually, at the right time, when the public would accept it, they would start to show themselves more often. They call themselves hidden masters. That was the old joke they used to call themselves. And everyone down below partied Hidden Masters, thinking it was something really occult, you know.
Yeah.
But in reality, they've always been here. And the public are now being trained to, because they will accept it. They will accept it. They're too socialized now. They will accept a world of experts running them. Had 40, 50 years of indoctrination along this path. And most people don't participate in elections or politics. They don't even care what's really happening in their own countries, most of them.
That's right.
So they're quite ready now for these people to come forward more officially as a parallel government.
Ah, so that this, as you say, this is the plan to, you know, with the name, the Bilderbergers, in that name, giving that, you know, implication of, you know, on a more psychological level, I guess, that, okay, these are the big boys, these are the rulers. But would you say that, because you refer to them as, you know, the navigators in that sense, would you say that the guys and gals attending the Bilderberg conference are these navigators?
They are a slightly lower order. At the top, they say that the hidden ones, the masters themselves, the captains of the ship, will not come forward until it's the right time. In other words, when the public are so dumbed down and docile that then they can come forward in safety. In the meantime, we see the ones who are officially titled already in the public's eyes, so they can still, but they still report to ones above them.
Okay.
Yeah, if you look down, in fact, at the old, where the banks are in England, if you go up into one of the high buildings and look down, you'll see the four banks with the obelisk they brought over from Egypt a long time ago. And you'll see the Temple Bar, where the Knights Templars had run the Exchequer, which is the British Treasury. But you'll also see where the roads come together, and you look down, where the pavement is, the sidewalk is in the form of a ship, and that deliberately was called the Ship of State. Because England was the one chosen to be the Ship of State, and the navigator will point the way. So this is old stuff, well understood at the top circles.
This is
unknown to the general public.
Okay, and this, I guess, is in the city of London you're talking about now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You know, there's some very interesting connections up actually when you bring up, you know, the Knights Templar and the Temple Bar and all of this. I briefly looked into you know, the history of some of the names of some of the attendees there, and I came upon the one name, Gordon Richardson, or Sir Gordon Richardson, a former governor of the Bank of England. And just on a, you know, side note here, but he was actually, in 1946, he was called into something called the Gray's Inn. And this is basically an area, you know, where they have all the manors of something called the Middle Temple, the Inner Temple, and Lincoln's Inn. Also, this is area where the Temple Bar, or, you know, all the barristers are gathered, basically.
Temple Bar.
Exactly, and one of the names they referred to was, as I said, was the Gray's Inn, and this was accordingly the manor house that was a property of someone called Reginald de Grey, or the first Baron Grey the Wilton. Don't know if you heard about this, but it all, as you say, all seems to connect with something called the Order of the British Empire and the Knights Templar, of course.
Yeah, the Order of the British Empire still is dished out every year to certain people even in Canada and Australia, New Zealand, etc.
Yeah.
And everyone who is at the top of your culture creation departments gets is awarded the Order of the British Empire. The OBE, yeah.
OBE, yeah.
But the grey, see, the grey part, we are talking about the Templars. The man in charge of the British Treasury, even today, appointed by Parliament, is still called the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, the Chequer is the chessboard inside, it's the courtyard inside the Temple Bar. You walk into it, it's actually a floor, which is a chessboard, and that's where the Templars used to, who were into loans, giving out loans and getting back interest. They used to put out, that's how they worked out their profit and loss. was on that floorboard. So even today, the guy in charge is still called the Chancellor of the Exchequer from the days of the Knights Templar. Hasn't changed.
There we go. Yeah, interesting.
The grey one is, in masonry, high masonry, the grey man is the man who walks between the two realities, the one the public sees and the one the public doesn't see, between the black and the white squares.
You know,
is a shade of grey. Grey men are those who are given higher orders, which few on the other sides will ever know.
You know, I'm very glad that you mentioned this, and I'm going to stretch things a bit here, but nonetheless, I'm going to give it out and see what your take on it, because it's very interesting that you mentioned the grey, because one of the members that I came across here, and this will lead kind of into two different avenues here, but one of the names I came across as a member of the Inner Temple was Bram Stoker, who of course made the myth of, you know, Dracula known, or he wrote that story basically. And the question, I guess, here, or the comment here is that I've heard, you know, that the some of these guys maybe have handling the gene technology back several hundred years with actually could lead to a person or different persons actually being able to extend their own lives, meaning that some of these guys actually at the top might be several hundred years old. I don't know. This is just an idea I threw out there, and I've heard it through other channels. Now, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but and one interesting thing here that I just wanted to connect with the grace and the name of the grace is, of course, that we have this popular idea of the image of what is known as the gray alien, you know. And the entire, you know, story here seems to kind of mud together, and it's a, you know, weird kind of mythological aspect on all of this, of course. But what's your take on all of this about the genes and stuff like that?
What we do know, what we can trace, is documented, is the Rosicrucian Manifesto that came out in the time of Queen Elizabeth I's court. It was the first openly Rosicrucian Masonic court that had come out in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And all her advisors were Rosicrucians. And the only thing they allowed the public to know was that they would give those who served the great work, as they called it. Now, the great work goes back to Plato, and before even to Pythagoras. The great work, anyone who served it, would be given life extension. We do know that.
Mm.
And sure enough, the main members you'll find in history, Benjamin Franklin and others, were given not just life extension. They were very potent right into their 80s when it came to the ladies and so on.
Yeah.
They had no problems in these areas. Today we watch the higher guys like Kissinger, Maurice Strong, both in their late 70s or 80s, globetrotting, putting in 14, 16 hours a day with tremendous energy.
Yeah.
And many, many more. Michael Sharp, who was a sort of... He was a guy in Canada who picked politicians. They used to go and see him before they were okayed, passed to get up the ladder.
Mm.
He died at his desk, working 14 hours a day in his 90s in Canada. No previous old age problems. None of them have old age problems. They simply die in their sleep, like the Queen Mother at 100 years of age. As far as gene technology goes, we know that Francis Bacon wrote about that in the novel The New Atlantis, where he described America, that's what it was about, a country to be born in the West. That would be have a form of republican democracy on the surface, but in reality would be run by a secret group of scientists. And he talked about being shown in the novel, in the last chapter, the visitor was allowed to see the laboratories underground, where they could create different life species by taking the most minute pieces of life and combining them together. Now, they weren't talking about grafting. And they said that we could actually create any kind of animal and know what the end product would be by mixing the different smallest particles of life before it was completed. So, in other words, it wasn't a new thing. Now, this was written in the days of candlelight to write with. The horse and buggy and sails on ships. And here he is. He also talked about a machine to control the weather.
Yeah? Oh, really?
So that was written in the late 1500s and published in 1602.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I'm sure, and the whole thing is, of course, the Rosicrucians at the top, like the Royal Society of England, which still exists today, was entirely composed of Rosicrucians and eventually Freemasons, still is today. Mm. He led all of the research into astronomy and genetic research and so on.
Yeah.
They dish out the grants from the big foundations to the scientists to explore certain areas. As far as Gray goes, we know that the novel based on Dorian Gray, the legend of Dorian Gray, was along the same lines of a man who could live for as long as his portrait didn't change.
Hmm.
He'd always stay young. So you know, a lot of little clues along there, but proof as such that they could live hundreds of years, at least not that group.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. And my, you know, my connections there are a bit obscured. I know that at least, you know, jumping from, you know, the Dracula myth over to the Gray Alien. But my, you know, consensus or my idea, you know, of that is, of course, that, you know, just explaining that there might be, you know, if this is the case, you know, that there are people who might be living at least, you know, longer than the average human being. That.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we have several things connecting there. Okay, we have the, you know, the myth of the Greys returning then as going back to the regional the Grey, like a kind of an incarnation, or that these people themselves, the Greys from the beginning, were, you know, are living on in this new aspect or the reincarnation or whatever, you know, through this.
Yeah, they do like to put this stuff out. Whether it's true or not, we just don't know.
No, of course.
We do know they have their own religion at the top. They certainly promote it to us, that is, to do with reincarnation. We know the ancient Romans, the wealthy families, believed that they came back in the same lineage as their family.
Mm.
So they technically had the lares, or the fires, going down below in the cellar, where they could watch the spirits of their ancestors, and when they died, they could become their great-grandson in the future type of thing.
Mm.
The pharaohs also had that same mythology.
Yeah.
That the pharaoh, especially when the pharaoh was dying or just died, they would bring in the son and lay him next to the sarcophagus, and they would perform the opening of the mouth ceremony.
Yeah.
The idea being that the father could literally transmigrate, as opposed to simple reincarnation, the spirit could leave the father and go into the son.
Yeah.
So the son could have more than one spirit within him, and that was one of the myths or rumors they put out as to why they were so clever. they incorporate the wisdom of their fathers and their fathers them.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, absolutely. Who knows, you know, if it's true or not, but there it is.
No, though, when you're talking about genetic research, one of the biggest and best mathematicians that Britain had in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was Rutherford.
Mm-hmm.
And Rutherford, in his own memoirs, wrote about being employed in his last years as a mathematician working for scientific research in England on genetic research. Now, that was back in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, supposedly, they hadn't discovered the gene until much later. So that's in his own biography.
Yeah.
Which meant, now, why would you need a mathematician if you could not see them and couldn't count them, for instance?
Yeah.
It tells you that they did know this stuff back then. Yeah.
Huh. Do you know anything about a guy called Henry Wellcome? This is about something known as the Wellcome Trust, and this was allegedly one of the funds for the Human Genome Project, or one of the leading, foundations that helped to, develop and map the human genome. I know, but I don't know if you know.
I know that the Wellcome is probably related to the Wellcome Pharmaceutical Company.
Probably.
No doubt.
Yeah.
I know that the Human Genome Project. No, the Human Genome Project is typically Masonically worded.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because genome, if you speak it, just gnome, which is a gnome.
That's right.
A little person.
That's right.
They've been mapping the genes of the common people.
Yeah.
But they've been, now they're admitting they've been doing it since about the 1950s,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
So they want to know all the different gene types of the common people.
Definitely. Yeah, and being able to map up the human organism in that way, and being able to, well, you know, again, this is ideas that are being implemented, that you can beforehand look if people are going to have traits of being, you know, a criminal or alcoholic or whatever, you know, and they can either remove that or the entire person before they even come into this world. So
that's the whole purpose. These guys at the top are eugenicists. Part of their religion is based on eugenics.
Mm.
And the superiority of different types or castes of people.
Yeah.
They've always been into this, and they've never changed. There's no reason why they should change.
Mm.
But they do want to map the common people for a future, more efficient society to serve them better.
Mm, yeah, indeed. You know, I want to return a little bit to again, the Bilderberg meeting there. Do you know if any of the things, or if many of the things that are discussed during these meetings are something that we can see, you know, traces of now being implemented? We can go back, you know, 1 year or several years or whatever. Because I'm saying this because I know that during the last, allegedly at least, during the last meeting in Ottawa, 2006, the depopulation agenda was apparently brought up, you know, where at least the idea of overpopulation were discussed and kind of addressed as, okay, this is a problem, we need to have a solution to this in some way. And I can certainly see that the idea of overpopulation is being, you know, introduced more and more by the day, basically. But do you know if anything more, you know, or other beyond that, or maybe verify what I just said there, that are being discussed on these meetings?
Yes, as I say, they've had a mandate since they've begun. It's always been the same mandate with the same goals. They have never varied their goals. They knew the world they wanted to bring into existence a long, long time ago. And the world, apart from being more efficient with also using science to guide the people and to also alter the people through different phases physically, biologically, the other phase was to depopulate the people. Now, they've been doing it since the 50s.
That's right.
Through inoculations. There's no doubt on that whatsoever.
Yeah.
We have no doubt. The statistics show it. Since the 50s, especially with polio vaccines and all the rest of it, you'll see people now with basically elderly diseases coming down with them, and they're even in adolescence now. Crippling arthritis and juvenile arthritis and things like this.
Could there be...
also note the sperm count in the male has dropped 75% since the 1950s. Three-quarters sterile already.
Yeah.
The fastest-growing business in America is a fertility clinic.
Oh, really?
And so it's male and female.
Yeah.
Biologically, we're seeing biophysical effects in the males, young males and females. They're different than they were 50 years ago at the same age.
So we,
the hips are disappearing in the female.
Yeah.
The guys are becoming very narrow frame, thin, and the guys are becoming more effeminate. It's because biological changes have taken place, because the brain itself and the various glands in the body were targeted by biowarfare techniques through inoculations. They could never come out and tell the public the truth now. They could never, ever admit to it what they've actually done.
So,
and yet if you go through history, what you do find is when these people have their big meetings and fund groups to promote something and do something, they will do it.
Yeah, they will just do it. I mean, I don't even know if we ever... Some researchers refer to that there is, meticulous, you know, documentation of every little step and move and stuff like this. But in a way, all these people have to do really is just to do it, follow up on it, implement it, and don't, you know, they don't have to instigate it in any way or document it meticulously. Yeah. But there might be, even as you say, there might be documentations. But the documentation in this sense might be the you know, whatever the UN reports on fertility or, you know, sterile, how many people are sterile, basically, I don't know.
In a day of crisis, with crisis creation everywhere, this is the time of crisis creation.
Mm.
Every year the United Nations comes out with the statistics.
Yeah.
And they always comment if it's out of their hands, if it's something that's happened out of their hands.
Mm-hmm.
But they reel off the sperm count in the male as it drops and have no comment on it.
Hmm. Yeah.
That is your proof that it's meant to be.
Oh, man.
Or there would be a comment on it.
That's right. And something would be, you know, a group would, you know, be... assess to this problem or whatever, you know, that, okay, we need to take care of this problem or research it and implement something. And I have no idea if something is going on that level, do you?
No, there are none. All you have are the population reduction groups
yeah.
run through various so-called, I think it's front feminist organizations,
mm.
like Planned Parenthood that was started off by Margaret Sanger,
mm, yeah.
who was funded from the top foundations.
Yeah.
She was a supporter of Adolf Hitler's policies and Stalin's policies.
Yeah.
And she was also a eugenicist. She wanted all inferior types killed off. She started off the whole Planned Parenthood agenda. All these characters are funded from the same source. The United Nations has massive departments to do with depopulation.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing to do with population or repopulation.
Yeah, there we
go. That's our clue about our great big wonderful United Nations.
So we might be fooling ourselves a bit if we're looking for a big bomb, so to speak, a big event where okay, now we can, you know, see that you know, X amount of people have been, you know, eradicated or whatever. We're looking for a big event that actually, you know, takes away a lot of people, you know, as a proof for the depopulation agenda. But again, as you say, this is more proof of a tippy toe tactic where this is, you know, slowly being implemented and a plan that stretches, you know, for I don't know what, 50 to 100 years maybe, and in a few years down the line we could then see the kind of hockey stick, you know, statistic basically when this takes off and people are, you know, babies aren't born and such. I don't know.
Yes. Thomas Malthus wrote his essays on population and population control. He was the first, but a big economist for the British royalty and their corporations, which they run, like the British East India Company.
Mm.
He also was an economist for most of the European royalty, and he wrote his essay on population reduction, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And in his suggestions, he talked about, you know, Britain and other countries had colonies where they used either slaves or very low-paid workers across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it all worked out right down to the diet, what kind of diet to feed them to keep them just functioning but not too bright.
Mm.
Just strong enough to do the work but not enough strength to walk off to another plantation for better conditions.
Mm.
This was done with meticulous detail. He was the one who wanted socialism to take over so that it could actually dominate the people. And the people themselves would pay for public housing, which would be built on unhealthy areas like swampland, where the conditions would start to kill them off, especially the very young.
Yeah.
This was all advocated in his treatise in the 1700s.
Yeah.
It's never really stopped. The elite have always been concerned about losing control over the people if it hits a magic number.
And I guess for, you know, during a time now than during the period that we've, you know, 50, 60, 70 years back, you know, that there have been interest in actually having a lot of people around for the ability to, you know, have them as workers, building a lot of stuff, you know, constructing a lot of stuff, you know, implementing the industrial age up to the point where we're at now, maybe, but so for a period, is it true, do you think, that there were interest in, you know, having a lot of people around to be able to implement the kind of industry that they have now, basically?
That's right. They knew, really, even partway through the industrial era, the industrial revolution, they knew it wouldn't last forever, that they would move offshore to cheaper places.
Mm.
And even then, at the height of the industrial era, they were planning the population reduction to follow.
Mm.
And sure enough, it was around after World War II, that's when they had signed in the treaties in World War II to start to de-industrialize countries like Britain in preparation for the European Union.
Yeah.
And in 1948, they set up governmental departments in every country in Europe that worked steadily on total integration of Europe, with population reduction to follow, with common laws to do with inoculations especially, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you'll see the population falling at the same rate in most countries. It wasn't just because people had more money to spend to buy a car or whatever.
Yeah.
It was also the fact they were becoming more infertile.
You know, this is interesting that you mentioned this too, of course. You know, with the EU and introduction of different countries into that, I was reading a little bit about George Soros. I think he was referred to or known for, you know, someone in quotes here, for breaking the Bank of England. And he even was connected with, helping to break, as it were, the Swedish currency during back in 1992, basically, help to devalue the crowns or kronas we have up here, the currency. And, and many claim that this was the kind of financial trouble, when this was implemented or when this was taken into place, that this actually helped to spur people, you know, out of fear, of course, but to go into the European Union to prevent things like this happening again. And
that's
it's,
right.
And it's very
the problem and offer the solution.
Exactly. And it's very interesting that during that time, our prime minister was Carl Bildt, and he, of course, is a Bilderberger, same as George Soros at that time. And you know, so there are, you know, a few connections here. I mean, they might be obscure in that sense again, but there, again, it seems to implement the idea that, okay, these guys are cooperating up there on that level because they know that they want to introduce the European Union as a first step. And in order for that to happen, we have to have some kind of, destabilized situation in those countries that are, you know, financially strong or don't have a reason maybe to enter these unions.
That's right. It's more the public who must be convinced. The elite are all in on the game.
Yeah.
And George Soros is basically a front man for Rothschild anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
You know, the Rothschilds don't only run the British system
and
the Bank of England, which is their treasury in a sense, but they also still have their private banks for lending as well. And Mr. Soros wouldn't make a move without permission from his boss.
Yeah, yeah.
But Soros did write a half page on how he did it in the British newspapers a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Openly boasting that he and two friends did it all on the phone. They chose to buy lots of bonds, then claim they're going to drop them all, panicked at the Bank of England, and that the Bank of England had to borrow from the international bankers, which also includes the Rothschilds again.
There you go.
To keep themselves afloat and devalue the pound. So they not only do they do it, they boast about it. However, the very fact that Mr. Soros is not only walking around today free and in one piece tells you he was authorized by the establishment itself.
Yeah.
Or he wouldn't be walking anywhere.
That's right. And it's so easy because I think we fool ourselves into believing that in that sense that there are, you know, people, you know, having control over this or regulating or being able to prevent this or whatever. I think, again, we have to remind, you know, everyone, and I have to do that myself, that we are living in their system. They created
That's
it.
Right.
They set that up. And it doesn't matter in that sense what we do as long as we keep fighting within that system, in a sense, because they can, you know, they control it, basically.
This is theirs. This is a psychopathic structure.
Yeah.
Which we've been trained to believe is reality because we were born into it.
Yeah.
The same as our parents before us. There's nothing humane in the system whatsoever.
You know, I'm thinking also about going back again to the Bilderbergers here, but Prince Bernhard, one of the, I know, and his I think his daughter, the Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, have been kind of referred to, I guess, as the glue that holds the, you know, the Bilderberg group together. I don't know. What's your take on what their particular role in all of this is?
Well, Bernhard, sure. I mean, he was so well known. He was a supporter of the Nazis. And
Do you know if he actually was a former SS Nazi officer?
I know he had a uniform given to them, but lots of them did. Even Prince Philip, the Queen of England's husband, his father, I've still got the photographs here of his father, who was also given an SS uniform by the Nazis.
Okay.
Lots of them wore the Nazi uniform and had been awarded it by the German Reichstag. You know.
Sure.
So they're all part of the same family, as you see, really at the top.
Yeah.
They're all related to each other. You read in history of the great experiments in history. The American Revolution with the Constitution was called an experiment.
Yeah.
The next thing they did, they also gave a form of democracy to other countries in Europe, including England. And they observed that. Then they gave communism to Russia and observed that. As each one in history, by the big authors, the authorized historians, is called a great experiment. And they watched all forms of it to see what was the best way, not to help the people, but to control the people.
Sure.
And in their own books, they say that this is from the big groups like the Club of Rome and so on. They say that the best one that they observed was communism. Because for an elite group to run it efficiently and quickly, make rapid changes, communism was the best way. So they were amalgamating democracy, fascism really, with communism to call it the third way, as Albert Toffler called it in his book. The bringing together for the next era of fascism at the top, that's public-private corporations, government and private business, international business tied together, with a communistic bureaucracy running a communistic people below them.
Do you know if
parallel government outside of it all,
they
can make rapid decisions and have them rapidly implemented without the slowness of the regular bureaucracies? That's the system that's in place today.
Okay, so but do you know if at that time a few countries have been named as kind of these first experimenters? Because I know that Sweden in some instance was named as the next developing stage after, you know, the collapse, or before, I guess, even, but before the Soviet Union collapsed in its first incarnation, at least. But I know the Sweden was mentioned as kind of that kind of political system. Have you heard about that?
Yes, they did. They observed Sweden and implemented a lot of changes there that were different than other countries. The big promoters from the 1800s, in fact, like H.G. Wells into the 1900s, Bertrand Russell and others, basically formed the type of school systems you'd have where they would promote early sexual contact and so on to see what effect it would have if it could possibly destroy the family. So they used Sweden and Denmark. That was another prototype for these methods to be introduced. Through the schooling system, too, to give a lot of communistic ideas but without going the whole way into the totalitarian-type regime.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It seems to be kind of a meandering about, and in a way I can see that a socialist mindset in that way is very, popularly promoted in the media and stuff like this, within the cultural movement and so forth, and it's a hint of it, in that way everywhere, but it's not fully drawn to the extent of how it was in the Soviet Union. But the mentality of it, or the thought of it, is kind of seems to lurk below the surface, so to speak.
Yes, and also it did have a desired effect, because they wanted to destroy. See, the family unit was very handy for them for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Since the days of the early Catholic Church and feudalism, which came into Europe at the same time, hand in hand. So they had to destroy the family unit now that it had served its purpose. And so they gave factions and promoted a separateness for the females, who would be given a different, slightly different chip on their shoulder than the males would have. This would cause dissension amongst people, make it almost impossible for them to stay together. So it was a training ground, you might say, with a lot of psychology and observation involved to see the effects, to see how it could be improved and implemented elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I keep, you know, returning to that. It's their system, and they set it up, and they experiment with it, and we, in a way, we shouldn't be surprised that this is going on, I guess.
Not at all. Not at all. And not only that, I mean, the CIA started up a lot, in fact, most of the left-wing organizations that were known in the U.S., and that people were battling over with right-wing and left-wing. It's now admitted that most of the left-wing organizations, especially in the culture creation industry, were actually run completely by the CIA and MI6 in England.
Yeah, it creates that...
They not only did that, they had 70 offices across the world, including Sweden.
Okay.
And they were heavily involved in the creation of the entertainment side, which gives you the ideas that children follow in Sweden.
So as long as people on the first level, or we can even have a system that is, more socialistic in a way from the people up to the, the representatives of the people. But as long as there is a group, you know, above them or working behind the scenes, it doesn't matter in a way what the people have, as long as they believe that they have the power to choose and pick and, you know, whatever.
That's right.
So.
That's right. You believe you have the power of choices, but in fact, they'll give you more choices. It doesn't take much because people don't think through all of the choices.
That's right.
They jump on the choices thinking it's freeing them, but actually is enslaving them and dividing them in another way.
Yeah, and they can even flood, the amount of choices that are being made, meaning that, the more you have to choose and pick, and because I know, you know, a few years ago when they privatized up here, you know, the telephone industry, the electric market, and we had, you know, different companies coming in, taking over parts of the electric grid and stuff like this. It all was about, you know, your tremendous freedom now when you can choose, you know, between company A or company B or whatever. But all that happened basically was that people was eventually fed up with making all the choices, so they just handed it over anyway, you know.
Yeah, you see, socialism is a great con. It always was a con. And again, now that they're so arrogant, they're publishing a lot of their declassified information from government departments on all of this. And the strategy was, now they knew they'd have to build countries up with electricity, water supplies, all the infrastructure that you see around you, they had to build it up. And rather than get their own money involved initially, they gave you socialism in the Western, in Europe. And all countries, including Britain, the taxpayer funded all of the infrastructure, the roads, everything. The electricity companies were all nationalized. And in would come the conservatives after it and say it was just so inefficient, now that it's all paid for, mind you.
That's right, yeah.
And they'd sell it for peanuts
to
their friends.
Yep.
This was all planned before it started.
Of course, yep. Yeah,
this happens over and over again.
It does, yep, absolutely.
And the public never learn because there's no inter-family history anymore or wisdom to pass on what happened 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no grandmother to say, wait a minute, you know.
Yeah.
This is what happened then.
That's
it's the
right.
same con. And so you can fool every generation now very simply by the same techniques.
Yeah. And again, I mean, we attend the schools that they from the beginning set up, and it's mandatory to go there, and you have to go in that learning system, and people are, you know, thinking that this is a privilege and not a, you know, the other way around, you know, that this is actually hurting, you know, many of the kids today, and it destroys their creativity, their spirituality, and a lot of this stuff. But they're actually, you know, again, just being trained as another brick in the wall, as it were, you know.
They're programmed for the changes which they will accept in their life. That's how carefully it is.
Mm.
The children are literally programmed by the year now as they go into kindergarten.
Yeah.
Beria, who was the chief of the NKVD, the secret police in Russia,
mm-hmm.
in 1934 gave a talk on intergenerational changes that they were creating. And he said then, this was to the Comintern, the International Communist Committee,
mm-hmm.
Which the future Prime Minister of Canada attended, since he was the head of the Communist Party at that time, that was Pierre Trudeau. And Beria said it used to take 70 years to indoctrinate changes through the children into society before you could see them accepting it.
Mm.
He said now, with scientific indoctrination, we can do it, make rapid changes every 5 years,
yeah.
and eventually it will be by the year. What he meant was a kindergarten child going in
yeah.
is being taught very scientifically indoctrinations which will be completely different from the society of his parents, so that he will accept the changes that he's been indoctrinated in without question as he goes through life.
Huh.
And then the ones the following year are even a bit more further forward than him,
mm.
and so on and so on.
Quicker and quicker.
It's so precise.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that some of these rulers up there might be looking upon, you know, previous civilizations as they rose and fell, and looking upon those as models and in a way admiring them, but the only problem with them was that they actually did fell and not, you know, okay, they have incarnated in different, you know, all the time in different, they take new shapes. It's not that it's not that black and white that they, you know, are there and then just disappear. But do you think that they would have the philosophical aspect to all of this, that, okay, we need to have a time for this kind of experimentation to actually develop a method to being able to, with that knowledge, then later implement a civilization that actually will, or an empire that actually will last, and being able to be also flexible, because some of these previous ones weren't that flexible, and when the people change, you know, the empire collapsed basically. But what they're looking for now is an empire that will you know, be flexible, as it were, with the people. And that's why I think if that's what you're referring to, that they can change, you know, every 5 years, every 10 years, every 1 year, or whatever, to be able to be flexible. What do you think?
They themselves, remember, have no compassion for ordinary people. They see themselves literally as a separate species. All psychopaths do, especially inbred psychopaths.
Mm.
They do know they're different. And they do know their need, up until the present, of the ordinary people to do all the work for them.
Mm.
We bring into being all of the plans that they want to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but however, they have already planned a future where they will take the base material. When they say base material, they're talking about the ordinary people.
Mm, yeah.
And that they will perfect them into different types of specialized humans for specific tasks.
Yeah.
That way, when we're all chipped and we don't think for ourselves, and we can't think at all for ourselves as an individual,
mm.
which they've written a lot about,
mm.
They'll have no more problems. Their only worry so far is that those who are aware in each generation, who are able to communicate what's really happening to the others,
mm.
Which often overthrows them.
Yeah.
That's why they give us bread in circuses in
yeah.
the days of Rome.
Yeah.
Now, Huxley said the only reason the previous elite fell, and it didn't fall, by the way, they always moved
yeah,
before the
right.
fall.
That's right.
But he said the reason those civilizations fell was the elite couldn't provide enough bread and circuses for the people.
There you go.
Now, that's why sports and all this stuff and massive television entertainment is put out in this present phase,
yeah.
is to keep us all mesmerized, occupied, and stupid and dumb.
Mm.
As they roll ahead with this agenda, because they will bring in the ultimate solution, which is their words, and that's the brain chip.
Mm.
That's the brain chip.
Yeah.
Their only problem then is, can they themselves, who really crave power,
mm.
all keep cooperating at the top? That's
yeah.
the only problem.
Yeah, that's right, because, I mean, in a way, I think there is a lot of infighting going on at the top, don't you think, also?
Yes. I mean, psychopaths have a great ability to act their way through life, and they do act their way through life. They can be tremendously cordial to each other when they have to combine. But in within themselves, each one really strives for higher power. It's the side effect of being a psychopath, they might say.
Yeah.
And that is also their other problem. However, they've even talked about ways to monitor each other, not with a brain chip, but with a form of a cap. They could, and they do have this technology, by the way. It can read your thoughts. There's no doubt about it. It's classified from the Pentagon. They have this equipment. It can actually read people's thoughts. It can insert thoughts into a person.
Yeah.
But it can also read your thoughts as you're thinking. And if it detects anything which is programmed as being wrong or deviant or whatever, it can send them back to the recipient, and then you will change your mind on something.
Oh, there we go. Isn't that nice? You know,
that rectify you as you walk.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, and this is no... I mean, as you say, they have the technology. I put up a news story, what was it, a few weeks ago, that actually talked about a toy, you know, developed from over in, I don't know if it's China or Japan or whatever, that actually responded to your brain waves and could, in that sense, pick up on what you were thinking.
Yeah, I give a talk on all the a lot of the declassified stuff and named it all with all the references from the Pentagon.
Oh, interesting.
A couple of weeks ago, too.
Oh, okay. Ah, interesting.
And this stuff does exist. Now, the elite have said they could wear a kind of a ring or a cap, something you could put on and off.
Yeah, okay.
Which would basically be able to keep each other in a cooperative frame of mind, you might say.
Yeah.
To stop them from turning on each other when there are no more enemies.
Yeah. Oh, my. It's the One Ring, you know. It's reminiscent of Sauron and all that.
It's also written in the book, the novel, the last one by Arthur C. Clarke, who gave us the agenda with the religion in it, actually, in a space form, a Space Odyssey 2001, and 2010, and 3001, those who run the world in those days, the elite, will have this kind of ring they can put on and off. They'll be able to take it on and off.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. My God, yeah.
They'll all sort of cooperate. If wicked thoughts, they could, they'll be rectified before they act on them.
Yeah, yeah. Alan, I think that's a great way to round things up for this time, and I want to again thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have you on, but as usual, before we go, you know, for potential new listeners out there and who people aren't aware of you, your work, or your website and all the stuff that you have on there for us, tell us about it before we finish up here.
They can go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com and Alan Watt, sentientsentinel.eu, for lots of free downloads on a lot of these topics. I give the references to the stuff. I don't speculate. If you speculate, you'll be lumped as a conspiracy theorist.
That's right.
I just give you the facts written by the elite themselves from dry, dusty, boring books. And I also have a couple of things for sale there. They're my own books I've written. And videos you can buy as well.
But by the way, Alan, before we finish off, I want to ask you, I guess you have a few DVDs out there. Are you producing any more of those? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this summer I am going to churn a bunch of them out.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's good. Yeah, I think that's a great way also to communicate these days when many people, you know, there's a lot of material out there, and one of the ways to deliver it, of course, is through Beyond Radio is, of course, video. So that's a good idea, I think.
Especially in a day where people are reading less and less.
That's right, that's right.
They don't have the concentration now.
That's right,
so
yeah.
DVDs, they're already trained to watch television, so sometimes it helps to stick in their mind what you're actually saying.
That's right, and in a way, I guess, you know, if we are to communicate this message to you know, more people in that way, we have to also use the mediums or the methods that are available to people, so I think that's a great way to do it, so. Alan, thank you so much for coming on. It has been a pleasure, as I said, and we will continue next month, okay?
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the program. Remember that you can participate in the show. You can comment or drop a question to one of our guests. Just click on radio in the menu on the left-hand side on our site redicecreations.com. In the radio section, you'll find all the details on how to leave your message or a question. Upcoming guests, we have Tom Horn from RaidersNewsNetwork.com to talk about his new upcoming book, Nephilim Stargates, the year 2012, and the return of the Watchers. We have Michael Sinanda to talk about the Gaia cycles in the theme of global warming. And we also have Michael Sharp coming back to the program to talk about the nature of consciousness. And we also have Andy Lloyd a little bit later in June to join us to talk about the dark star / Planet X. So good things ahead. Also, don't forget to check out our forum and our subscriber section if you want to have full access to all that is Red Eyes Creations. And today we're going to do something a little bit different in the subscriber section. We're going to feature a talk by past researcher and Masonic scholar Manly Palmer Hall. This is an excellent lecture or talk called Jacob's Ladder That Leads to the Stars. This is not an interview, but a lecture on a tremendously interesting and also very important topic. So all subscribers, join us as we listen to this brilliant talk with Manly Palmer Hall. Thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren, and Red Eyes Creations Radio will be back on Thursday again. Until then, take good care. Down the stairs, out the door.